Okay, the licensing division, the committee will come to order. We have quorum. Representative Abler, you want to move the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair. They're excellent.
Okay, Representative moves the minutes from March 30th, 2009.
I remember it well. It was a great day.
Yeah. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motions carry. Minutes adopted. We have in front of us Representative Tilbury, House File 2995. I will move House File 2995 and recommend a pass and be referred to the Committee on K-12. Oh, I'm sorry. Health Human Service Policy. Okay. Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want you to know, Mr. Chair, that it wasn't my idea totally for that letter jacket. I just want you to know that.
Oh.
But, Mr. Chair, in this particular bill that we have, I do have an amendment, I believe, that has to be also looked at, which would be an A-10-2165.
Yes. The Chair will also move the A-10-2165 amendment. This is the author's amendment, I believe.
Correct.
To get the bill in the shape that the author wants. And then after we remove, you'll probably explain what the bill and the whole amendment is.
Right.
I assume. Okay. Yes. Those in favor of the A-10-2165 signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Okay. Representative Tilbury to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And definitely, when I first took this particular bill, I thought it was just a kind of a word change. I am meeting all kinds of people that are just...
Representative Tilbury, nothing in this committee is...
I'm finding that out.
Is that easy, yeah.
And so the intention for this bill is really to make sure that professionals who are already, by statute, legally able to diagnose ADD and ADHD are able to have that diagnosis accepted by schools for purposes of special ed. This bill is not intended to change who can diagnose ADD and ADHD, but rather allow students who are already working with a certified mental health professional to get that diagnosis brought into the school setting for purposes of assessing special education. As the statute currently reads, schools will not accept a student's diagnosis of ADD, ADHD if it was made by a clinical social worker or another appropriately licensed professional in a community setting. This creates a hardship for a student who needs to access special ed services through the school because they need to then obtain another diagnosis of the same issue, which means another copay, another trip to see yet another professional. The professionals listed in the 245.4871 statute are already allowed by statute to make this diagnosis and currently do so when appropriate. The only difference is that schools do not recognize this as their diagnosis because it doesn't find itself in that particular spot. And that is the bill. So the amendment covers six areas that list out the definitions, and I know that there's really no dispute or not much of the dispute for issues 1 through 4. 5 and 6, there are some people that don't agree with that, and no one knew what number 7 was about anyway that I've talked to. They didn't even know what that number 7 was supposed to be there for, so that is what I'm deleting out of that section.
Okay.
And I stand for any questions.
Why don't we have the full testimony, and then we'll do the questions by members.
All right.
State your name for the record, and then you may proceed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Ochaki. I'm the president of the Minnesota School Social Workers Association. It's our organization's mission to reduce barriers for student success in the areas of social, emotional, and also in their environments. And as such, I'm here tonight to talk with you about House File 2995. The Minnesota School Social Workers Association is hoping to reduce barriers that prevent families from exploring the help that their child may need at school. Current law demands that if a family whose child has ADHD is involved in an assessment for special education under the other health disability category, assigned ADHD diagnosis from a medical doctor, nurse, or licensed psychologist is one criterion for qualification. Before last year, the law required that the ADHD diagnosis come only from a medical doctor, but last year the legislation was expanded to include psychologists and nurses. This expansion of the mental health professionals whose ADHD diagnosis can be utilized for the other health disabilities special education assessment has been a move in the right direction by the legislature. However, as school social workers poised at the juncture between school and the community, we see that barriers still exist. Many children see qualified professionals in clinics and counseling agencies, such as LICSWs or licensed independent clinical social workers. Including these qualified mental health professionals, who are already defined by state statute, will prevent a family from having to incur additional costs of both time and money. School social workers across the state have heard complaints from families in this situation who have had to make additional appointments, withstand extended wait times, inability to pay for the extra transportation or secure that transportation to appointments, and of course pay additional co-pays or out-of-pocket costs if they don't have insurance. These additional barriers really can be enough to prevent a family to be able to get that second diagnosis to say they have the ADHD, which is a critical piece of the qualification for the other health disabilities category. We believe that asking a family to see another professional when they have already received a diagnosis from a mental health professional qualified to give the ADHD diagnosis puts undue burden on the family when they are seeking out assistance from the school to explore the other health disabilities special education qualification. The changes we're presenting today will not increase the number of children diagnosed with ADHD. You're not talking about changing that diagnosis criteria. Nor will the number of children who will be qualified under the other health disabilities category change, as the ADHD diagnosis alone does not qualify a child for special education. There's other testing and procedures that are in place in the schools. The diagnosis from the mental health provider is one piece of the qualification. Because school social workers connect the students and families in the school, we see that allowing medical doctors, nurses, licensed psychologists, and LICSWs to use their differential diagnosis of ADHD to count for the educational purposes when exploring this in schools, this will greatly reduce barriers to students' academic success. We can ensure that no family must explore additional supports because of the extra runaround that they're having to do and the extra doubling up of service when they are talking to the school about help for their child. I very much appreciate your time and attention to this information. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We also have some David Gibson that signed up to testify for, I assume, for the bill. And then I was told that someone in the audience is also here to answer questions if need be. Forgot the name, sorry. But if there's any question you need to come up and answer, feel free. Mr. Gibson.
Yes, my name is David Gibson, and I'm the past president of the Minnesota Society for Clinical Social Work and a adjunct professor at the University of St. Kate, St. Thomas, teaching psychopathology. And the Clinical Society as a group is in support of this bill. We do feel that clinical social workers are trained in differential diagnosis. As a professor of that topic, I do teach students about the importance of multidisciplinary team in doing that. I do think that the social work education does support that, and I do believe that social workers are qualified to do that. And the Minnesota Society for Clinical Social Work is in support of the bill.
Very good. Anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Just go up to the podium and state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
My name is Dr. Tricia Stark, and I'm a licensed psychologist and also the Director of Professional Affairs for the Minnesota Psychological Association. Mr. Chair and representatives, ADD and ADHD are difficult diagnoses to make. There are many conditions that can cause behaviors that appear to be attention deficit disorder. It requires a skilled diagnostician to make a careful differential diagnosis to isolate the cause or causes of a child's behavior, and as a consequence, identify the appropriate treatment. The gold standard for diagnosis is to include input from a child psychiatrist or a behavioral pediatrician, a psychologist, and a social worker. For a child to be identified, behaviors must be pervasive, occurring in several settings, including school, home, peers, and the community, and they must be severe. Symptoms must be significantly interfering with functioning in these domains. These behaviors need to be measured against a standard or norm that is developmentally appropriate for a child. This requires the use of sophisticated assessment instruments. The implication of a diagnosis given to a school can have a long-standing impact on a child's educational career. We owe it to children to ensure that they are carefully and accurately diagnosed. Rather than expand the population of individuals who can make diagnoses, I believe we should be refining, not diluting, the credentials of who we allow to assign diagnoses to our children. This includes physicians, psychologists, and social workers. We really need specialists because of the long-term implications of diagnosis. In a pamphlet for parents and caregivers of children who may have ADD or ADHD, the Department of Health and Human Services, a division of the National Institute of Health, answered the following question in this way. If ADHD is suspected, to whom can the family turn? What kind of specialist do they need? And the answer is, and I quote, "Ideally, the diagnosis should be made by a professional in your area with training in ADHD or in the diagnosis of mental disorders. Child psychiatrists and psychologists, developmental behavioral pediatricians, or behavioral neurologists are the most often trained in differential diagnosis. Clinical social workers may also have such training. As psychologists, we support the recommendations of the Department of Health and Human Services and cannot support including other mental health professionals in those who can provide ADD and ADHD diagnosis to schools for evaluation of appropriateness for special education services."
State your name for the record, and you may proceed.
My name is Seymour Gross. I'm a licensed psychologist with a doctoral degree. I taught at the University of Minnesota at the Institute of Child Development for 37 years, a particular course called Introduction to Clinical Child Psychology. I'm active with the Minnesota Psychological Association, and that is why I am here today to oppose the expansion rather than the refinement and the enhancement of services. The diagnosis of ADD, ADHD requires that the provider have supervised training with children and youth. It requires training with a wide range of children, children with special education, children who are not having special education. It's an easy task to look at a very active child and then say, must be ADD or must be ADHD. That's just the tip of the iceberg. That's the beginning of it, because there are many other diagnoses, many other conditions that mimic or that include overactivity. To begin with, there are healthy, normal children who are highly active their temperament is a high level of activity. Unfortunately, over the years, many of these children have been labeled with the attention deficit hyperactivity disorder rather than saying this is their normal tempo and that it they don't need treatment. There are multiple diagnoses to consider. One is physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Overactive children who have been abused easily are seen as overactive. Child neglect, family dysfunction, anxiety disorders, traumatic brain injury. Child with a traumatic brain injury may be quite active and have problems with concentration. There's the oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorders. Children that get into trouble get into the juvenile court who may be mislabeled as having the attention deficit disorder. Children with communication disorders, some children who have hearing problems that have not been detected until a little bit later than it should be, may be overactive. Other kinds of brain injury. Children with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder can easily be overactive and mislabeled, and the fetal alcohol diagnosis is missed. Childhood schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and various other health disorders. So that simply saying because a mental health professional has had some coursework about ADD and ADHD, that qualifies them. It is simply insufficient. It is not unusual, in fact, fairly typical, that pediatricians, neurologists, and psychiatrists, child psychiatrists, refer children whom they think may be having the diagnosis, refer them to psychologists, because we also include psychological testing. We do family observations. We do objective measurements to be filled out, inventories to be filled out by the school teacher, by the parents, by the child, for the older child, and by the school social worker. So it is a far more complex task than to have a particular section of a course in your graduate training about this and then to believe that you have the qualifications for that. Thank you.
We do have, and we're going to bring both the proponent and opponent back to the table as well, and then we'll start with the questioning from the members. Representative Norton?
Well, I don't know that I have a question, Mr. Chair, but I do feel like I need to make comment. My background prior to coming to the legislature was in special education. I worked particularly in the area of early childhood, so I have that experience. I also come as a parent of a child with a very difficult to diagnose attention disorder, so I bring that as well. And I'm extremely uncomfortable with this particular language. And I guess in my own circumstance, which I really hate to talk about here, but it's really what I have to share, so I'm going to. We did have work with a physician. We were eventually referred to a psychologist and went through quite a long series of testing. I think in the end we like many people, had a borderline kind of diagnosis, and without it moving ahead with a particular IEP type plan, we were able to utilize 504 plans, which students and parents can utilize now. So part of my point is that with or without a diagnosis, there is help for students with ADD in our public schools with proper advocacy and information to parents. I will also say that my son probably had oppositional and defiant disorder and has just finished 6 years in the U.S. Air Force. So I'm not sure what that says about our my son or the services, but it actually has been a very good thing for him because the structure was very positive. I am very uncomfortable, having worked for many years both in special ed and as a parent who's experienced firsthand many of these issues, with expanding the definition to mental health professional under this particular statute. And I think part of the reason is many cases of ADD are difficult to diagnose. One of the things that might happen without appropriate, what I feel would be appropriate psychological evaluation and testing, is an increase actually in diagnosis, which could be an official cost burden on our school districts. And as I said, there's already the 504 plans for those that are borderline, or a parent may feel that the child needs special accommodation. So I guess I'm not comfortable with this. I'm far more comfortable, given my own special ed background and personal background, with the licensed physician, actually the current language, and licensed psychologist making those diagnoses. And I would prefer, and will be voting against, expanding that in this piece of legislation.
Representative Tilbury, there was maybe you or your testifier could address the training piece. It was brought up that can you address the training with her?
And perhaps testing too, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
There was significant testing involved in diagnosis for ADD for many students.
So address those two issues in regards to wanting the ability to diagnose.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two people here that are willing to answer that question.
Can we just maybe repeat it? I was trying to find out if I would be the one to answer this question. Could you repeat that, please? Ms. Ochaki. Yes, Ochaki. Stephanie Ochaki.
Sorry. I'm tall, so it's difficult as well. can you address the training that your group has?
Sure.
In relationship to your ability to diagnose ADHD?
What I would say, and I know we've had testifiers earlier that maybe could speak more to that, is I hear they have, you know, the training that they are giving to professionals training. But what I would say is that our statute already does allow the mental health professionals listed that they can make that differential diagnosis of ADHD. This legislation today is not about expanding who can make the diagnosis of ADHD, as it's already outlined in state statute. This legislation is about saying that if a family takes their child to see the provider of their choice that they feel comfortable with, helping them sort through the issues that their child is having, the concerns that they have, that diagnosis will then be the part of the special education evaluation, if that's what the family is interested in. The special education evaluation includes many different pieces. Testing at the school, the diagnoses of ADHD is one criterion that is necessary in order to explore the other health disability category when a child's concerns are with ADHD.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Chair Tao. Mrs. Ochi or others, the issue seems like what the discussion has become about is whether or not you are qualified to diagnose at all. Okay, that's what the issues raised by the psychologists. So if you could give us a little bit of the history of when the statute language occurred that you were you were included in terms of being qualified to diagnose these,
yeah.
And who made that determination? I mean, were any of these categories that kind of the history of who made that determination and why?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can tell you that licensed independent clinical social workers have been able to provide mental health diagnoses in the state of Minnesota since 1987.
Representative Bunn.
Well, has that always included this particular diagnosis as well, these two diagnoses?
Mr. Chair, I do not know the answer to that question. There may be another.
There's a gentleman. Yes, state your name for the record.
My name is Bruce Miner. I teach in marriage and family therapy program at Argosy University. I also was the clinical director of Reuben Lynn Family Services in Minneapolis for 20 years. And I can tell you that since 1999, marriage and family therapists have been included. The decision was made by the state legislature when the decision was made to include them as mental health professionals. And that is both in federal statute and in state statute, mm-hmm. that there are five professions that have that meet all of the criteria to be able to diagnose and treat. So since 1999 in the state and much longer federally. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, or members, did I?
Representative Blunt?
If you could then address the issue, their actual critique, then, of the reasons why. I mean, the questions really got at a little bit of this, but specifically, that you know, you heard the list of things they talked about. So if you could address the issues they raised and whether or not your experience in training has exposed you to those things or not.
Yes, I can. Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I believe. I have a little bit of a visual impairment. LICSWs, LMFTs, and now LPCCs, Licensed Professional Clinical Counselors, all are required to go through training and differential diagnosis. The issues that were raised by my colleague, Dr. Gross, who I worked with for many years in the community, are trying to refight an old war. It's about fencing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I can tell you, as somebody who's worked in the community for many years, and I can also tell you as a grandfather who has a daughter who has this diagnosis, the social workers were right to bring this forward. I referred my, or my granddaughter was referred. My daughter has a terminal illness that brought up issues for her. She was referred to an LICSW because I'm too connected in the MFT community. She was receiving services during her testing and assessment. Attention, ADD was brought up and diagnosed. That was sent to the school as, well, possibly you might want to look at some services. My granddaughter needed to go get a neuropsych evaluation in order to be considered, which, because my daughter with the terminal illness has continued to work instead of just taking her disability, she falls through the cracks, so a great expense. She had to go outside of her community and wait on a long waiting list, and then go through a set of diagnoses. By the way, they never met with the family. The checklist that in this neuropsych asked one question: does this show up in schools? You know, it's. I would say that the people who are working in the community, the people who are working at the Native American Health Center, the people who are working at Kente Circle, are much closer to the community, and they're much more likely to look at and meet with families. They're much more likely to go to the schools and get the input from the schools. So this idea, this is just another old fencing war that has been settled many years ago by this legislature, and I don't know why would we be, why we be revisiting it.
One last question, hopefully, on this. If the core issue about ability to diagnose was settled long ago, assuming that that was settled on evidence-based information, why was this particular angle of it, the extending it to being able to be qualified for the school districts, and maybe Representative Norton, you might be able to address this too with your experience in the school districts and with ADHD, not included at that time? Why has this been, I mean, there it must have been, it sounds like it must have been something intentional there. So any of the testifiers, if they have comments on that, the psychologist or your group, I'd like to hear that.
I believe, my name is David Gibson, I'm from the Minnesota Society for Clinical Social Work, and I believe that has to do with the whole idea of other health impaired. ADHD falls under another category. There's emotional behavior disordered, mm-hmm. IEPs, and then there's other health impaired. And ADHD was not considered under the emotional behavior disorder, but other health impaired, so it was seen as a health issue. So it came under the purview of MDs, I think, initially. Mm-hmm. But there is a standard of practice that you can look at for the American Academy of Pediatrics, I believe, that talks about differential diagnosis in this case, and it talks about multidisciplinary work. It talks about using a variety of different means, the family assessment, the school assessment, some sort of test like a TOVA or a CPT, which are computerized tests that look for ADHD. So in doing the differential, you want to look at all of these things. And social, in terms of clinical social work, in my teaching of that, I do teach and talk to that and believe that when you're doing the diagnosis, you do consult with the physician. You do consult with a child psychologist or the school psychologist. It's a team approach. With ADHD, I would never diagnose all by myself. And I think that most ethical, well-educated mental health professionals think about their scope of practice and the ethics of their profession when they're diagnosing, and they have no intention of over-diagnosing, and they want to follow what is kind of the standard of diagnosing a particular diagnosis so that you're not getting it wrong. Because I've been in the field for 26 years. I've worked with kids for 30. Part of that was not special ed kids, but that shorter period of time was special ed kids. And I've seen kids misdiagnosed, and I've seen the damage that does. I've seen what meds can do to kids if it's for the wrong diagnosis. And so I think that's a part of the education that we talk about. Clinical social workers, too, their coursework is they do get the psychopathology class. They do get a human behavior and social environment class that looks at the client within the whole system. And then they are required to do 4,000 hours of supervised practice where they are having to do cases, look at cases, and do differential diagnosis and have them reviewed and learn how to do that kind of process. So in terms of clinical social work, I think there is adequate training to be included in that group.
Representative Talberry, where is this in the Senate? Has there been some movement on your bill?
As far as I know, it was tabled at one point, and it's sitting there right now in that committee.
I know that members that the bill will have to also go through the K-12 as well, and I certainly think.
I serve on that committee.
Yes, I certainly think there's some merits in exploring this idea further. And what, Representative Norton?
I was just following up, and I really appreciate, and I have no problem with the team approach, and I talked to some of you ahead of time. I think a team approach is probably ideal, which negates the argument that it's cheaper to just have the social worker do it. I'm okay with a team approach. And one of the questions I was talking to some of the folks out in the hall with had to do with assessment, and it's very clear to me from the definition that social workers go through particular training to do certain assessments. Some of those assessments will help with ADD, perhaps ADD diagnosis, but there are other assessments that social workers are not trained to do that also can be used for ADD diagnosis, MMPI and some others, that aren't necessarily just to identify ADD, but are more holistic approaches to see if there are other underlying conditions besides ADD that might be considered. Without those tools at hand, I think we are disallowing perhaps that holistic and that broad approach to diagnosing our children with what might really be. If you're only looking for ADD and you try two tests or whatever tests the social workers, and I don't know the names of them, I apologize. But if you use those tests and the child qualifies, you can give them an ADD diagnosis. Had you used a broader scale like the MMPI and had the other tools that the psychologists, for instance, have at their hand, you might notice that they have tendencies for ADD, but they might have a much broader picture. And so I asked some questions out in the hall. I just wanted to share. Clearly, there is some assessment training that psychologists go through. There's also a more comprehensive training that social workers go through. There's a broader, more comprehensive set of testing and assessments that psychologists do. And again, I think social workers are an integral part of a team approach, but I don't think as a standalone to be able to diagnose a child with a single diagnosis that's then handed to the school district that needs to be accepted on its face value is a comfort to me at this point.
But Representative Norton, I believe even if we pass this, the team approach will still be there. Isn't that true?
Certainly it could be, yes.
Yeah. So
Mr. Chair.
Representative Talbot, you have the last say, and then we're probably going to move this on.
Well, first of all, I can really appreciate Representative Norton and your point of view and so on. And I know that it's difficult when you do have a special ed student that is your child. I also have one. And I can really sympathize with that. And you know, since he was qualified for that since third grade. So I'm looking at it as, you know, if a student goes into the special ed piece through the school, there's a minimum of 30 days that they have to do their testings and so on. There's also the point of having to wait for an appointment to get in to see other people if that's the situation. After a while, it's about 6 months before you actually get anywhere to get somebody at a spot in the special ed program at times. Not everyone would need that particular piece. So I would say that, once again, the intention of this bill was to make sure that professionals who are already by statute legally able to diagnose ADD and ADHD, so then schools would accept that for special ed.
The chair spoke too soon. Rep. Simon has one additional question, then we'll move on.
Well,
to.
I had wanted my when I made my original question, I wanted the psychologist to be able to answer too if they wanted, but I think Rep. Norton kind of responded partially from their perspective. But before we move on to final things, since I won't have testifiers, I just learned in my future committee when I hear this again, is I'd like to hear your response, the school social workers, to Representative Norton's comments about the different levels of testing capability, or you know, whether levels or different types of testing available to you, and how if the team approach didn't occur, that maybe it would be a more narrow range of things that could be detected. Detected from the testing that you're capable of, as opposed to the psychologist or a larger group.
Mr. Gibson.
Yeah. David Gibson from the Minnesota Society for Clinical Social Work. You know, I think social workers are trained in systems theory, and we look at the whole system, the family, and we look at the other professionals that are involved in the case. And if I might not be able to administer an MMPI, but I would be able to look at a kid and say, this kid looks like there's something going on there. I'm going to do what I can do, and if that doesn't, you know, if there's still something doesn't look right, I'm going to refer to a child psychiatrist. I'm going to refer to a psychologist. That's a part of ethical clinical practice, and that's what we're taught. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, I don't expect that clinical social workers can do everything. We're not supposed to do. I mean, there's stuff that psychologists do and social workers do, but social workers do know when to say, you know, this is something. There's a question here. Who's the appropriate person? Is this a neuropsychological or a psychological issue? And you refer for that. And so that's what we would do under that set of circumstances. The kind of, yeah.
Just final comment. I mean, these are tough issues, and
uh-huh.
I'm learning that we're going to have less opportunity for future discussion than I had thought. So I'm willing to move forward on this, but I'll be watching this. I'm not sure that I'm convinced of this. I mean, if this can be for me in a future committee or on the floor. But I think that certainly deserves more discussion at the legislature. So, okay.
Okay. Seeing no more testimony or questions, the chair renews his motion that House File 2995 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You may leave.
Yeah.
Representative Rood.
Don't ever come back here.
Representative Rube moves You want to move your own bill, Representative Rubin?
Sure. House File 2969, and I think...
We're probably going to... Representative Rubin moves 2969, recommend it pass and refer to the Committee on Health.
Right.
And Human Services Policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment, if we could move that so the bill could be in the shape.
Okay. Is it the 810?
2144.
2144. Representative Rule moves the 810-2144. Put the bill in the shape that the author wants. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that is brought forward by the Minnesota Department of Health. It includes some technical changes in the licensing provision that has to do with audiologists and speech-language pathologists. And I am going to turn it over to my testifiers, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair, so they can explain those technical changes.
That'll be fine.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today to this committee. My name is Catherine Dittbrenner-Lloyd, and I work for the Minnesota Department of Health in the Health Occupations Program. And as Representative Root indicated, we are proposing some changes in House File 2969 to make changes to occupational regulations concerning speech-language pathologists, audiologists, occupational therapists. And so what I'll do is provide you just some brief background information about the bill, you know, how it came about, and then just some very brief go through each section and each chain. Basically, program staff on a regular basis identifies needs for changes while conducting regulatory activities as part of the day-to-day operations. And staff also identifies ways to streamline operations and to reduce regulatory burdens on practitioners. These proposals have been discussed with our stakeholders, and there is no opposition or controversy. And further, the changes have no measurable fiscal impact. And so I will move and just talk a little bit about each section very briefly. Section number one, this change under section one.
Well, usually, Ms. Lloyd, if you don't have a lot of opposition, you real short and then moves a lot faster.
Okay, I'll go really fast here. I'll put my fast voice on. So thank you, Mr. Chair. The first change just deletes language that addresses the inconsistency in the regulations. Currently, the regulations require licensees submit their report of continuing educations at the same time as they submit their license renewal. And the deletion is needed because the current regulations, we allow practitioners actually 30 days after the renewal to submit their CEs. So it just deletes a conflicting language. And Section 2, this change eliminates a requirement that the department's communications that we send to practitioners during an investigation be sent via certified mail. It's not necessary that all written requests the department makes to practitioners be sent by certified mail. In most cases, we use regular mail, and the department can use certified mail if we need evidence of receipt by the practitioner. Section number three, this change adds language to correct a previous drafting oversight by inserting a six-month time limit for completion of 480 hours of the supervised practice. This 480 hours of supervised practice is required when people apply for their licensures many years after they actually graduate and without additional education or experience. Currently, there's no time limit on when they must obtain that 480 hours, whereas applicants who apply for licensure after a delay of 2 months or more must complete 2 years or more, excuse me, must complete their 160 hours of supervised practice within 2 months. Therefore, again, it's just correcting from last year's language. And then finally, Section 4 and 5, which is the amendment. This deletes language and eliminates a requirement that occupational therapy practitioners or applicants for temporary licensure simultaneously submit their application for a full permanent licensure. And this change promotes regulatory efficiency because temporary licenses vary from 90 days to 6 months. And during this time frame, applicants are transitioning from school to work or perhaps moving from another state. And their initial address and employment information often changes. So requiring the applicant to submit both their temporary and permanent licensure at the same time often requires department staff multiple follow-up communications to revise and update license and information.
And I take it Mr. Hendemeyer is just there in case we have questions, right?
Moral support.
Okay. Good. Are there any questions from the members? Okay, seems like a pretty just technical. Representative Rue renews her motion that House File 2969 be recommended pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Health Care and Human Services Policy and Oversight. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes carry.
Thank you,
on your
Mr.
way.
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, Representative Abler. And for this, for House File 1503, the chair will keep an eye on the clock. And the proponents have 15 minutes. You can use it in however way you want. The opponent has 15 minutes. They could use it however they want. And then the committee members will ask questions after that. And I believe, Ms. Ave, is there a... Oh. I think we have a couple amendments or something.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll move the bill.
Okay.
And then I'll offer the delete all, which is the A-10-2013 amendment.
Okay. Representative Abler moves 1503... And
Mr. Chair, there's an oral amendment that's just technical, which maybe I'll just do that now and incorporate it, which would be simpler. And I'll read that if I can. It's I talked to some of the people in the audience who helped write this, and it's on line on page 3.
Yes.
And the amendment would be this: to delete line 3.17, and on line 18, 3.18, delete the diagnosis of. And insert diagnosing.
Mm-hmm.
And then on line 3.19, I believe we would insert changing in front of recommendations. And then delete by and insert of. So it would read changing recommendations of. And I believe that cleans that up to make it far more readable. And if I am allowed to, I'd like to incorporate that into my amendment.
Representative Abler moves the oral amendment to put in the shape that the author wants.
I can probably incorporate it, but I just...
Well, Representative Abler just incorporated, I was just told. So it's been incorporated.
Yeah.
And
then we could adopt the amendment, if you like, Mr. Chair.
And then I believe you haven't moved your delete all yet.
Right, so if we could... So I'll move the A-10-2013 amendment as amended.
Okay.
And we should vote on that.
Okay, all those in favor of the delete all amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motions carry.
And just to get it all the amending done, Mr. Chair, I don't have remember the number of my little tiny amendment there, but there was a technical omission on a different bill I had where there was the deletion of a rule was left off of the conference committee for House File 1760. It was adopted on the floor on House Law 535 last year and just got left off as tracking. And so I have both amendments if anybody wants to read the amendments and how it worked out. But the if I could move that amendment, I just need a place to carry that little correction language, and I've just picked this as a vehicle.
Representative Abra, I believe this is just a technical.
Yes.
And Ms. Aves will be able to explain the amendment. Ms. Aves?
Mr. Chair, last year... there was a change made to the chiropractic law where a rule was put into statute. That was added as an amendment to the omnibus licensing bill on the House floor, the new language and the repealer. I made a mistake, I'll fess up, in drafting it as an amendment to Representative Thiessen's health policy bill. I did not include the repealer. This is to fix that mistake and repeal the rule that has been enacted into law. So it's very technical. There's no secrets or anything.
I don't see any hands. So Representative Abel moves the 1503A1.
Sure.
The technical amendment.
That's technical.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Ayes carried. Okay, Representative Abel, I believe your bill is in the shape that it's supposed to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that 15 minutes would be great for both sides. And this has been discussed for years, actually. If you're new here, welcome to the discussion. The idea of having a credential for a massage therapist is not new, but it's been controversial, and part of it has to do has been the state of mandatory or optional. I've carried this bill off and on for, it seems like, ever. But I think that it's down to a point that makes a lot of sense, especially given the news that there was a Mounsey massage therapist who had a hard time behaving and was arrested. And the world of massage therapy has been regulated as though it's prostitution, which probably worked in 1800, but it really doesn't make any sense in 2010. Massage therapists now are, the field has come just a tremendous way, and if you go visit the programs where they teach the anatomy and all the techniques that they have, they're a very skilled part of the health team. And I, as a consumer protection, to me, that I bring this forward and out of respect for the development of the profession, that those who achieve a credential, a certain level of practice standard, should be allowed to have a credential. And we chose registration as opposed to licensure, as opposed to keep it a little, that was a compromise as well, which made sense. And so it's a voluntary registration given criteria. And I think it meets every standard that you can imagine for warranting a credential. And I offer it my enthusiastic support. My witness will introduce himself, and then you'll hear some witnesses, and we'll stand for questions at the end.
Okay. State your name for the record, and you may continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Miller. I've been a professional massage therapist since 1997. And I currently work at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in the Department of Integrated Medicine. I'm here tonight in the capacity of the Government Relations Chair for the American Massage Therapy Association's Minnesota Chapter and the Chair of the Grassroots Group, the Alliance for Licensing Massage Therapists. Massage therapy, as Representative Abor alluded, is an allied healthcare profession and is regulated as such in 43 states and the District of Columbia. The clinical benefits of massage therapy are being published in peer-reviewed medical journals, and those benefits are observable regardless of the setting in which the massage is received. Massage therapy is the only health field in Minnesota regulated at the municipal level. These local licensing ordinances cut access to care for clients by being overly burdensome in cost or scope of regulation and have no city-to-city reciprocity. Massage therapists, for example, who cannot afford to pay Wyzetta's $8,300 fee in addition to Brooklyn Center's $3,500 fee, either refuse to go to clients in those cities or, unfortunately, practice illegally. Under this bill, access to care for clients will be dramatically opened up, as those massage therapists who voluntarily become registered would be exempted from these city ordinances. This bill would remove a massive and onerous regulatory burden from the backs of small business owners in Minnesota. As a small business owner myself in West Virginia, I saw this positive difference being state credentialed can make. I started my business prior to the passage of West Virginia's licensing law and continued to practice there after that law took effect, and the changes could not have been more stark. The difference in the way my practice was viewed by referring providers, business partners, and most importantly, potential clients, was like night and day. And now, though I live and practice in Minnesota, I maintain my West Virginia license to this day because having that state credential makes a palpable difference in how I'm viewed by potential clients, other professionals, and potential employers. Massage therapy was regulated by the Minnesota CAM law. This law, even before it was defunded, however, was ineffective at handling the caseload brought by the regulation of massage therapists, and the CAM law offers no means of fielding or investigating client complaints to protect the public in light of it being defunded. In the 43 states with massage credentialing, complaints per 1,000 practitioners last year ran as high as 28 complaints per 1,000 massage therapists. This is higher than the reported ratios from the last biennial reports for Minnesota nurses, physical therapists, and social workers combined. There is a clear need to protect the public, and this was verified in the Minnesota Council of Health Board's 2009 report on massage therapy. Some of the highlights of that report include the overall, and I'm reading this verbatim, the overall compelling state interest in the regulation of massage therapy is the protection of public safety. Physical health consequences of incompetent, improperly trained, or unethical practitioners include significant public harm. State regulation would support standardization of competency and would increase public safety. The Pew Commission on Healthcare Regulation uses massage therapy as an example of a profession where title protection is appropriate. The public is protected by giving clients a choice to see a massage therapist who has chosen to be regulated or not. Pass this bill and massage therapy clients can know that their practitioner they choose to see has been vetted for not just competency, but relevant criminal history, malpractice insurance, and Minnesota-specific regulatory criteria standards. Pass this bill, and when a regulated professional does step out of bounds, there will be an effective means of holding him or her accountable. Pass this bill, and clients will see a dramatic increase in the access to care. I urge you to vote yes on this, on House File 1503 as amended. I thank you again for the opportunity to come before you this evening, and I'll cut the rest of my testimony short and be happy to stand for questions later.
Thank you. We have Chuck Sawyer and Dale Haley next. Chuck Sawyer first and Dale Haley.
Go ahead, Chuck. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good evening. My name is Dr. Charles Sawyer, and I'm the Senior Vice President and former Provost at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. With me this evening is Dr. Dale Haley. We appreciate that, the opportunity to speak to you in support of House File 1503, which will create a statewide mechanism for the voluntary registration of massage therapists. It will occur within the Board of Nursing and is budget neutral for the state of Minnesota. Northwestern is a regionally accredited educational and research institution that, in addition to training doctors of chiropractic and oriental medicine practitioners, provides opportunities for massage therapists to prepare for entry into the healthcare delivery system. We support 1503 not because it's the ideal or perfect bill, or that the public is a grave risk without it, but it is a needed, logical, and evolutionary step for a rapidly growing health profession here in Minnesota. And Minnesota is currently one of only seven states without some form of statewide licensure or registration, and in many states that have regulatory statutes, were enacted 30 years ago or longer. The only two states for which there is no regulation of any kind or is pending are Idaho and Wyoming. The most compelling arguments for registration rests with the qualifications, expertise, and the value of massage therapists as members of a healthcare profession. For example, in a 2009 survey conducted by the American Massage Therapy Association, consumers reported seeking help from a massage therapist as often for medical reasons as for relaxation or stress reduction. And it seems to me the latter also constitute bona fide health care. Federally funded clinical trial research at our own institution involving the care of patients with acute and chronic low back pain also includes massage therapists on the care team, along with doctors of chiropractic, medical physicians, and other providers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Sawyer. We have Dale Haley.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Dale Haley. I'm the Dean of the School of Massage Therapy at Northwestern Health Sciences University. I'm thankful for the opportunity to address you today in favor of House File 1503. I've been involved in this effort for several years now, and I think it's long overdue to put this bill in place. Just to speak very briefly about massage therapy as a healthcare profession, we're educating healthcare professionals. Medical students come to our school to learn about massage therapy and how they can incorporate it into their practice. Hospitals increasingly are offering massage therapy as a treatment for patients. CAM use in hospitals increased from 7.7% in 1998 to 37% in 2007, and massage therapy is the number one CAM therapy offered in hospitals. There's a number of efforts nationally in the field of massage therapy that speak to its legitimacy as a healthcare profession, including, not limited to, the Massage Therapy Foundation, the Body of Knowledge Initiative, the Best Practices Committee of the Massage Therapy Foundation, on which I serve, and many other many other initiatives. I think last thing I want to say, this is a voluntary registration, so those that feel the current regulations are sufficient to regulate their practice, they're free to stick with those, but this is voluntary for those who choose to want to have portable practices and be able to have freedom of movement around the state. So thank you for your time.
Good. We have Ann Finn from the League of Cities. 5 minutes left. You don't have to take it all.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I do have a handout for the committee just stating our position on this issue. First, just a quick disclaimer. I've never been in front of this committee before, and our city officials and those of us who represent them are actually much more comfortable talking about things like potholes, even this year. So I'm a little out of my element. We do represent the 854 cities in Minnesota, and I'll tell you that most of those folks are ill-equipped to regulate health occupations. And as a result of that, local licensure for massage therapists is costly, it's overly complex, it's inefficient, and as you heard earlier, it's inconsistent from community to community. Cities we know are not required to regulate massage therapists, but they do so in an effort to control crime, like prostitution and other criminal activity. In short, cities want to be out of the business of trying to regulate massage therapists. In order to accomplish this, they need the assurance that there is some oversight of this profession, and that's what this bill would accomplish.
Ms. Finn, do you know how much the city uses the percentage of its resources to police massage therapists or massage industry?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't. And it would, I think, really depend on what kind of activities were happening in any given city. I think, especially in our smaller communities where they have small police departments, they perhaps rely on the county sheriff for their service, they may not have ever dealt with any massage therapist operation until someone decides to come in and open a business. And that puts the city then in the position of trying to figure out how to make sure that that's actually the business that the business owner is representing it to be. So I can't quantify in terms of police costs, but I will tell you that there is an interest in making sure that residents are safe and that community stays vital. And when there's suspicion around a business, it causes concern.
Representative Norton, you have one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I definitely, when this was first brought to me, see this as a small business issue and that's looking for regulation. I don't necessarily know that it belongs in this particular licensing realm and discussion. That's my personal opinion. But I guess I'm a little concerned with the testimony I just heard and the testimony before with regard to the idea of the 28 complaints out of 1,000 and the crime issues. If it's voluntary, how is a voluntary registration really going to get a handle on that?
Mr. Chair, I think for the cities, this would make it easier to pass an ordinance that gave some assurance of safety. What I envision a city doing is saying that someone who wants to open a business in the community would have to be registered with the state. That would assure them then that this person has had appropriate background checks, etc., and that would get them out of the business of trying to figure out what would be an appropriate background for this person to have.
Mr. Chair, so for clarification, so a city could, after this is passed, even though it's voluntary registration, and I've gotten lots of concerned letters in the last couple days about this, a city could make a regulation that you need to be licensed in order to get a permit? Is that what I'm hearing you say? That there could be some regulation and that only people that register would be allowed to practice?
Well, Representative Norton, there's nothing here that says we can't, that we prohibit the city from doing that. So theoretically,
right.
Yes, they can.
Right, so that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
So
yes,
so people who are concerned that they're being massage therapists that have contacted me that don't support this could actually be run out of business if they choose not to register is what I'm getting at. And it sounds like that is the case.
Possible.
Thank you.
Representative Ava?
And to that point, the beauty of this is that by regulating this group and giving them a credential, you have something to take away if they're not good. And so people know that that's good. But our city right now, given the testimony of Ms. Finn, is that they don't know how to regulate these. They could require that they have a national credential now. They could require that they've had, they could put this whole bill in their statute if they would choose to now. And I want to remind that this has been a concern expressed by the people who oppose this bill, and I remind them that the city councils are usually seven people or five or whatever, and it's their neighbors. And so to make an ordinance requires some work, and so all they have to do is just remind them of what good neighbors they are. And I expect, rather than cities rewriting all their ordinances, that they would, if they're registered by the state, they'd just leave them alone, and if they're not going to choose to do that, they would then continue as they did and collect the $200 or $8,300 or whatever. So that would be, having dealt with my city council on this very matter, that would be another option that could well happen. I think especially in the smaller towns, you'd see that.
Well, right now, you're right, Representative Abler, right now every city could potentially, are regulating by themselves. And so it makes it tough for the massage therapist to go from one city to the next one. They have different regulations, which makes it tough. So, Representative Bunn, did you have one?
Yeah. First question on this. It wasn't my question that you started this one. I'd like to ask Mr. Hittlemeyer from the Department of Health whether on this issue a city actually could do that. I mean, currently existing, if this was voluntary and they were continuing to practice not as a registered massage therapist but as a practitioner massage therapist under 146A, could a city in fact tell the 146A practitioner they would no longer be welcome in the city even if they were willing to pay a business license?
Mr.
Legally?
Hindemeyer.
Run away while you can. I think they could do anything they want. Can't escape.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I'm Tom Hindemeyer of the Minnesota Department of Health. And Representative Bunn, I missed the first part of your question. I was having a conversation.
Well, the conversation went, that's okay, sorry. I understood. Sorry to catch you off guard. The line of discussion was about whether under this, if this were passed, or if a city passed identical language on its own, but at a city level, that there was something called a registered massage therapist that had title protection from a registered massage therapist, whether then anyone else, whether a city could write an ordinance saying only registered massage therapists can practice in our city. My question is, wouldn't a massage therapist not with the word registered in front of their name still be able to practice legally under state law on 146A, and the city couldn't tell them you just can't practice here? They could have a business license requirement of that person, but could they really not allow them to practice massage in their community?
Mr. Hindemeyer?
Under 146A.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, I believe that a city ordinance would be effective on its terms, and that unless the state law said that it had a greater authority than the city law and supplanted it, that the city ordinance would be effective. And I think that we currently have or had the situation when 146A was effective that many cities did license and regulated their massage practitioners under those ordinances. Our Complementary and Alternative Practice Act enabled the state to remove the right to practice from massage practitioners who violated criminal statutes or other provisions when that was appropriate.
Mr. Chair, so I take away from this then that this registration, although voluntary, could de facto become a licensure standard if every city in the state passed an ordinance that said, unless you are registered, you can't practice in our community. Is that a correct line of thought?
That makes sense to me, Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn. That makes sense to me. And, a registration system is stronger the more titles that it protects.
Representative Bunn.
I'd like now to turn to the core issue. Thank you, Mr. Hindemeyer. of what this committee is about, which we seem to have not even addressed yet, which is we've been talking about the issue of, you know, city needs and maybe criminal contact and those kinds of things. But the core issue of this committee is health and safety. And the core question then is what is the health and safety risk that exists out there that is the problem we're trying to solve with this? And specifically, how does this legislation comprehensively, including in its grandfathering, address that health and safety issue?
Rep. I'm able to make it short, and then we'll move to
we still have a lot to testify. People don't know what they're getting. The word massage is not defined, and it's an unregulated practice. And so under 146A, the person need only tell people they fill out that informed consent thing, the disclosure, and then they do what they wish. A massage therapist could be somebody who has just been at a party and learned how to do it, or they could be somebody who is extremely talented. And as Minnesota, in my view, people like to know what they're getting. And so if they're harmed by a registered massage therapist, should this become law, then there's some recourse. They have a board, or at least an advisory council they can go to. The nursing board is not a slouch to have derelict providers running around. And so there is somewhere for them to go. And there's also some assurance that there's a standard that's maintained. Many people who remain unregistered will also have a fine standard, but that will be an undefined standard. And evidence of that is people get arrested for being bad. And this is a high incidence of people who, than other professions, even when they're registered. And so when they make the paper for being hauled off in handcuffs for inappropriate touching, that's what we're protecting them from. And so if they did that, if they were even sort of inappropriate and not criminally, there's a place they can go to, you as a client could go to and have relief. So I think we should take the testimony just to, in the interest of time, if that's all right. So.
The proponents took 10 minutes for their testimony and 10 for questions. I'll be fair for everyone else. Up next, we have the neutral, Kathleen Pritchard, and then on deck is Carrie Johnson Polivar. Yeah, they took 10. Yeah, I know.
Good evening, Chairman Taub. And members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Picard. I'm a licensed physical therapist, and I practice in an independent practice. I am here tonight representing the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. I call your attention to a document that's being distributed at this time. It is what we call our filter. It is a summary or kind of a condensed version of a larger document entitled Changes in Healthcare Professions Scope of Practice, Legislative Considerations. It was a document that was put together by representatives of six different healthcare regulatory organizations in an effort to provide a filter or a viewing point, if you wish, when you're looking at scope of practice and licensing bills. And it is the filter that we use to look at the language for the massage therapy bill, House File 1503. It is, incidentally, the filter we look at all licensing bills through, and we invite that you would do the same. We have worked with the Alliance on language about this bill for over a year, and we've gone back and forth in cooperation with each other, and we are happy to say that we stand neutral on this bill.
Okay. Thank you. And Ms. Carrie Johnson Polivar.
Thank you. Palava. Yes.
Palava.
Yes.
Sorry.
Thank you. Chair Tao and representatives, thank you for allowing me to speak this evening. I am one of the founders and directors of Centerpoint Massage and Shiatsu Therapy School and Clinic, and we are potentially the oldest school for massage and shiatsu in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and we may be the largest, and we may be graduating more therapeutic body workers than any other school in Minnesota right now. Historically, we initiated a collaborative effort in 1991, which was an inclusive effort for therapeutic bodywork in the state of Minnesota to include all bodywork modalities, not to just regulate massage therapy. Massage worked closely with the Asian bodywork therapy community, representing Asian bodywork modalities, which include Shiatsu, Tuina, Jinshindo. And we worked from 1991 to 2007, so for 16 years, my partner in business, Jackson Petersburg, and I were very much leading the legislative effort. In 2008, a secret meeting happened, and Asian bodywork therapy was summarily removed from the bill that we had drafted from all effort to move forward, and Asian bodywork therapists were just basically told, either we can write our own exemption, or the committee moving forward would do it for us. The current bill is a very narrow bill, and it's discriminatory. The field of massage or therapeutic bodywork is larger than just a narrow definition of massage. In massage, the definition in this bill includes Asian bodywork therapy, but Asian bodywork therapy is excluded from being represented by this bill. Shiatsu, which is part of the larger Asian bodywork therapy profession, is a viable profession both locally and nationally. I'll call it ABT. ABT has a national professional association and a national certification exam with a clear definition and a scope of practice. The movers and shakers on this bill basically bullied the local AOBTA chapter into an exemption. We do not want to be exempted. We have asked for that we would like to be included. We would like this opened up to all bodywork modalities that would like to be included. I believe the League of Cities might be interested to regulate Asian bodywork therapy, since most of the illicit businesses that are opening are under the auspices of Asian massage, and you see that throughout the state of Minnesota. Many states have adopted bills with a narrow definition, which has resulted in limiting the ability for other forms of therapeutic bodywork from practicing. And it's very scary to think that the cities could then require this regulation, this voluntary registration. The states of Florida and Connecticut have bills where Asian shiatsu therapists cannot practice. What's really important is in the description of prohibited practices, there is a practice described as moxibustion, which is being exempted from this bill, or which moxibustion is being included as a prohibited practice. Moxibustion is within the scope of practice of Asian bodywork therapy, of shiatsu. My school has to teach moxibustion for the shiatsu therapists to practice and to learn to take the national certification exam. It is considered a prohibited practice, and the massage therapists of the graduates of our East-West Therapeutic Bodywork Program would be committing a misdemeanor, according to this bill, if they practiced moxibustion. Yes.
Ms. Johnson, so you're saying because this bill is voluntary, and if you don't sign up, you can't represent ALEP. Do I have it right? If you don't sign up and register, you're not part, you can't call yourself as such, and I don't think this prohibits anyone else from practicing what they practice.
We would like to be part of a regulation. I would like to represent our graduates of an East-West therapeutic bodywork program, and to make sure that they, if they become registered massage therapists, that they would not be prohibited from practicing scope of practice of Asian bodywork therapy as well. We also know that when a state passes a voluntary regulation, it often converts to a licensing bill. This is narrow and exclusive. We would like to see more work done on this bill to make it inclusive. I'm not opposed to regulation. I'm opposed to the narrow scope of this regulation, which really is representing, you know, everybody who spoke was from Northwestern Health Science University. It was not inclusive of all schools and all education in therapeutic body work.
I understand. I had this similar conversation with another group who want to jump on into another bill, and my response was, if you desire such legislation, get it drafted, and then we'll give you a hearing, and we'll go through the whole formality. I don't like to, I don't know, just personally, if one particular group has pushed forward with something, if another group wants to jump on and piggyback on it, I don't mind if the other group doesn't mind, but you have just as much ability to introduce similar legislation to include you in. But I think that's something that Reps on Able and the massage therapist, Reps on Able.
I was just chatting with some of the people in the audience. As I read this, and my full intent is to fence no one out from doing what they do. I don't know what your school, how many hours your school has, but it occurs to at least my little panel there that your graduates would probably qualify to be registered under this bill because of their training. And if they wanted to do moxibustion and the other things that are listed as not being part of massage therapy, you would just revert to do that as under 146A. This was meant to, I think that a lot of that is covered. I carried the bill a few years ago, including Asian body workers, and it didn't get very far. So not for that or any reason, it just wasn't the year to do it. And so, as Representative Tao said, this is a massage bill. It's not an Asian body worker bill. And, you know, actually no Asian body worker ever came and talked to me about this bill or I think even the other one. But I think that as I interpret what I'm writing here, I think that if you chose to work in a city as a massage therapist, that you wouldn't be prohibited from doing moxibustion. Just that this says that's not the scope of a massage therapist, but you could do that as a 146A therapist, but to disclose, et cetera.
Ms. Pavlik.
May I ask a question, Representative Abler? If a graduate of our East West Therapeutic Bodywork Program, which is 1,275 hours, which includes training in moxibustion and massage therapy and shiatsu therapy, and they wanted to be registered because it's the movement towards healthcare, which we heard a lot about. If they wanted to practice moxibustion as a registered massage therapist, would they be able to?
Ms. Chair, as I read this, that's not in the scope of massage therapy. And the reason that's true, you can have two credentials. You have one. Massage therapy isn't moxibustion. Massage therapists don't do moxibustion. There's a list of things they don't get to do. They don't practice medicine. They don't diagnose. And they don't do some things. And that's why there's a little niche that they fill. An Asian body worker would have had additional training to do more things, but those would be wearing a different hat. And there may be someday come when these bills, a separate bill comes along or that's discussed. But I think they're compatible, but it's a kind of a different question.
Okay, then I would like to ask, because it has happened in other states where a bill for an Asian bodywork law has tried to pass after a massage therapy law has been in place, and they've required the Asian bodywork therapist to then just get licensed as a massage therapist. It's the same thing. And that's what I'm concerned about. And secondly, I'm very concerned that there's another adjunct therapy for shiatsu therapists and Asian bodywork therapists called cupping that a lot of massage therapists are doing without appropriate training. And so I would like to put that with the moxibustion, that would be a prohibited, if you would like Asian bodywork therapy to be in its own realm and its own bill, which is possible. If that's your recommendation, I may not agree with that. However, then I would ask that cupping be included as part of the prohibitions for massage therapy.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eva.
Just the interest of time and not making the committee look at all the list of these things, I think that I should invite this woman to my office and we can chat about this and see if we can find some accommodation.
And we did work together for years.
Yeah, and I'm happy. Then good for you. So that's good.
Good. All right. Next.
Thank you.
Okay, we go to the, now we're to the opponents. We'll give you your 15 minutes, and then we'll do the questions. Then Representative Avery will have his final say, and then we'll vote. Barbara York and Gregory Schmidt is on deck. You could go in a different order if you need. I believe Nancy Hone is there as well. You may start. Introduce your to the committee and state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
I'm nervous. I don't know how many years I do this, I get nervous. But my knees aren't knocking. Chairman Tao, representatives, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Hone. I am the co-founder of the Natural Health Practitioners of Minnesota, the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project, and the Minnesota Natural Health Coalition. I'm also a registered nurse and have been a traditional naturopath for over 30 years. I stand before you today, however, as the president of Natural Health Practitioners of Minnesota to represent the organization. And the next part, I can see when I cut and paste it, I left out a word. If you're looking at my thing there, it says, we stand in opposition of any further, I left the word further out, of state regulation in any form of the healing art of massage therapy. We do believe in public protection, and that's why I helped pass 146A in the year 2000. We already have what is needed in the state of Minnesota. I'll just make a few brief points and defer the rest of the testimony to Mr. Schmidt and Ms. York. But our organization hardly supports the same position. In studying the supportive documents for this proposed state regulation, we take objection to some of the following points, but it was not an inclusive list of our objections. Number one, please do not attempt to solve the prostitution problem on the backs of healers. It will not work. Number two, Minnesota Statute 146A that I personally worked hard to pass with thousands of ordinary consumer citizens in 2000 has been working very well for 9 years. In fact, massage therapists have been investigated and shut down under this statute to protect the public. It has legally provided consumers with healthy choices. With the high cost of health care, we need to be nourishing that freedom and not working to reduce it. For the record, I believe the previous people said that the CAM law has been defunded. The CAM law was defunded. The CAM law is not gone out of business, just the Office of Complaints. And in fact, 7 other states have followed suit on this great freedom issue, and only one other state has got an Office of Complaints. All the others are working with natural health freedom without a complaint office. So we're still in business of protecting the public in that regard. In fact, this is not a consumer protection bill, as Representative Bunn said, noted, that this is and that's what government regulation is about, to protect the public. Consumers are not demanding this legislation. As you can see, special interests are. Massage has been a healing modality since mankind began. Massage did not need government regulation then, and it does not need it now or any further than we have already put in place. It has been proven safe and health-giving since the beginning of time. People have not changed. This healing art has not changed. Although this proposed bill is brought to you today as voluntary registration in all states that started with voluntary registration, they soon became mandatory licensure. This is the camel's nose under the tent for further and stricter regulation. Number five, the argument that some massage therapists work in multiple municipalities and cannot afford multiple licenses we empathize with and can easily be solved with simple language of preemption that we have already developed language for with our attorney. We are willing to work with the League of Cities to solve this problem more simply and rather than this huge effort that is being put forward. More simply so everyone, for everyone, so that the cities and the therapists feel more comfortable. It is said that it is time to get recognition for good work of massage therapists. You cannot legislate morality in the case of getting rid of prostitution, and you can't legislate recognition. You do that by doing a good job, being an upstanding citizen in your community. This is how you get respect and recognition, and how I and my colleagues have done for 35 years. Lastly, we need not fix something that is not broken. Strengthening Minnesota Statute 146A, the Complementary and Alternative Health Freedom of Access Act, with preemption language for the municipalities, we do support, but not in this way. State regulation of therapeutic massage has never been needed for centuries and is not needed now. Our organization asks you to oppose HF 1503 and seek to solve the stated problems with much easier solutions. Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gregory Schmidt. I am president of Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. It's a consumer-based organization. I am a consumer of natural health practices and a carpenter by trade. So for me, this is not an issue of a turf battle. Members, you swore to uphold the Constitution and abide by the laws of the state when you became legislators. I believe we ought to follow existing statutes before enacting more. Chapter 214, and I'm paraphrasing rather than read the entire statute, although I have put it in your packet, says in subdivision 2, no regulation shall be imposed unless required for the safety and well-being of the citizens. Chapter 146A, as it been stated, adequately protects the citizens. Please see the enclosed document from Diane Miller for references in greater detail. In terms of the concerns from the cities, if the requirements of Chapter 146A are followed, those issues are covered. Number one, if you do not provide the disclosure notice and a client bill of rights, you are disqualified as a 146A practitioner. Two, if your client bill of rights and disclosure are fraudulent, you are disqualified. Number three, if you provide a client bill of rights and disclosure notice but engage in sexual transgressions or predatory action, you have violated criminal statutes and are disqualified from practicing under Chapter 146A. The issue of practitioners working in multiple locations and having jurisdictions charge them wildly varying fees is an issue that cities will have to resolve. Cities are able to impose fees for business licenses, however outrageous they may seem. This committee and this legislature are not charged with recognition or acknowledgement of professions. This is not the congratulations, way to go, attaboy, attagirl committee. This proposal is a solution looking for a problem. There is no issue of need here. Assurance of the public is not your task. Unfortunately, the proponents are using consumer protection arguments and using the issue of prostitution as a scare tactic to advance a title protection bill, the most self-serving, non-consumer-oriented type of proposal there is. Please vote no on this bill.
Ms. York.
I have documents.
My name is Barbara York. I'm the president of the Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Network. We've also included our name to involve touch and movement practitioners, which would be somatic educators, etc. We are a nonprofit organization. We're run by and for practitioners, and we are not affiliated with any school or insurance group. We have been supporting and protecting the practice of massage, touch therapy, and somatic education since 1981. We are the oldest practice organization in the state. Our board members are volunteers. We do not have any paid lobbyists, and I have been working with these, with this whole thought and the 214 since 1987. You'll notice that the proponents of this bill are all from schools, or AMTA, which is a national organization that has a drive to have this come through for them. They are also connected with commissions that accredit schools as well. We don't have a school problem per se in the state. We have over 45 schools across the state now. It's a business that people seek education for. You don't need to regulate that, they must. The MTMN has been a proponent of good regulation. We have been purported to be opposed to regulation, and yet we have helped pass important pieces of legislation in the state of Minnesota. The Statute 146A, which is the Minnesota Health Care Freedom Act, and an amendment to the Chapter 609. Both consumer protection laws and supported by consumers and practitioners. And yet the proponents did not support either of these bills. They have publicly, including influencing an I-Team report on TV, denigrated the 146A instead of using it as a teaching opportunity. The 146A has allowed practitioners of many modalities to practice without creating the turf wars that you've seen in the previous hearings today and that you've heard between the schools themselves. In their own documentation, which I was not invited or aware of the meeting that took place this summer, this is the material that was presented, and these are my comments on it. There is a lot of problems, a lot of contradictions in their own material, but I'll quote from their material, as you'll see right here. This organization, the AMTA, serves as an equivalent to the United Nations in dealing between these related but separate forms of manual therapy in areas such as state regulations, scope of practice, and other areas that may negatively affect the ability of practitioners of that field to practice. This is turf wars. The 609 raised the penalty for massage therapists who are sexual predators to a felony. The MTMN testified in favor of the amendment before the Crimes Victims Subcommittee. Sadly for our profession, Karen Long of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, which is a voice for victims and survivors, sexual assault programs, and allies committed to ending sexual violence, stated that she had contacted the ABMP, another national organization that sells professional liability insurance, asked them for support, and received a reply stating that they could only offer a neutral stance. And yet they're talking here in their documentation, which I've labeled sex, that the cases that were brought out in the public venues, it's all about sexual assault. Our bill, our amendment on 609, made it a felony. It's not a felony under this registration bill. It is under the 609 because we, the proponents of good regulation, helped get it there. Though this is touted as a voluntary registration, the cities can make this mandatory, as you've been hearing, potentially even more cities than already have, as witnessed in other voluntary registration states. The city prostitution issues, as you'll see, Lisa McDonald, who was my city council member, past council member, granted, wrote this to a previous author of a bill, said, in all the time I was a council member, and even during the times we talked about licensing, we never had a case of complaint against a massage therapist. We got much better results when we focused on the saunas instead of therapists, because that's where the illegality was. Karen Turner, who was also a council member, wanted to introduce ordinance language against massage therapists, much like these regulations, these registration bills. But the city later changed course when it realized that massage therapists weren't the problem, but rather the saunas. And if you'll notice in Minneapolis, we don't have a sauna problem anymore. But Bloomington, which has a really wonderful, tough ordinance, does have problems with prostitution under their licensing. Florida has a long-standing licensure program, yet you could get a massage from a company, and this is from a friend who has moved to Florida, from a company called Oriental Mystery Massage. It is known that prostitutes go to the schooling and receive their license. It still for the cities, it still involves undercover work. They have to go in and have the therapist, the so-called therapist, but we all know it's prostitutes. No one walks into a prostitute place and returns because they're confused. It's very clear. But they have to have that, the prostitute, offer them sex. Under the 146A, they don't even have to take their clothes off. They can walk out of there with a 146A client bill of rights. It's an easier tool for all the cities. I was at the national gathering of the League of Cities, and we spoke to many cities across the country, representatives, and explained the 146A. The 146A has not been explained by the schools that try to represent this regulation. The cost of the consumers, the price will not come down. They will stay the same and even rise as the field becomes narrower, eliminating a lot of the part-timers who are just making ends meet. Sometimes it supplements their income.
Ms. York, you have one more minute.
The choices will go down and the prices will go up. States that have licensing are double what we charge here. Education hours go down. You'll see there's a quote here that though there's 500 hours, there have been 720 hours, and what has happened is that some of the practitioners, they say, I got enough with 500, so they don't go to school, and so educators are finding that problem. Harm to the practitioners. The schools that offer 250 hours, now some of them are gone, and those people will have to go back to school. If you look at the listing of how many practitioners are in the state of Minnesota, we'll say an average of 3,000. What we're looking at is only 795 got their national exam, which means that they'll have to go and spend a lot of money to get there. And then you'll see that we have medical recognition and that all the consumer things were either under the 146A because of fuzzy boundaries, which the health department knows is a big problem regardless of licensing, and the others are criminal acts that were covered by the 609.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for these testifiers?
Pardon?
Okay. Representative Norton?
Thank you, Mr. I just have a general question, and I wasn't paying attention, I'm sorry, at the very beginning when you said where this would go, because as I look at this, it appears there are quite a few cost centers in here. I see fiscal notes probably needed due to the criminal penalty, as well as an advisory council that we're putting in law. So is this going to where?
Representative Norton, this will go to Representative Thiessen's committee, the policy, and then after that it's going to go to Representative Clark's, which is a finance committee, and
criminal penalty under either Representative Hillstrom or Representative Mullery's committee as well?
None of those folks have requested the bill yet, but I believe maybe Representative
It had a criminal penalty, which is why I thought it probably needed to go
Chair.
As well. But
Representative Abler?
We know we have a few stops to make. We're not sure exactly which ones, but it'll get to go the gauntlet. So
it seems like it's a long road. It's just the beginning. Any additional questions, Representative Bunn? No?
Overall, or at least?
Right now, overall, we're discussing, and we're probably going to take a vote in 10 minutes or five. Go ahead, Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Representative Schall. First of all, clarification was told this evening that when it goes to health policy, that we're supposed to just be rubber stamping it there and not having testimony or further amendments. Is that also amendments, or that's just testimony?
Representative Bond, what we have done in the past is I present the committee report, and if we need to fix certain piece of the bill, we do in that committee as well.
Are you committing to that in health policy we can make changes to this bill?
This is Representative Abler's bill, and so I think it would have to go through Representative Abler on that. So,
Mr. Chair, and
I'm open to anything.
I'd love to talk to you about this bill. So.
Well, let me go to my questions and comments then. First of all, Representative Abler and advocates, I asked the question about the key thing. It's supposed to be about health and safety. We've gone into the whole discussion about the issue about distinguishing between prostitution and legitimate massage, and I really did intend us to have the health and safety discussion, which we haven't had yet.
And I'm uncomfortable passing this out without having that discussion and having us see the evidence for that. In the 214 report from last year, it does list instances where physical harm can be done to people, and this is whether they're practicing under 146 or we would call them a registered massage therapist. And the question is for us to evaluate whether that harm really does occur, in my view. And moreover, whether or not there's training that actually can help massage therapists know when there's contraindications, people identify them so as to avoid that kind of harm, and whether the training assists that. Moreover, it goes to the issue of not only the number of hours of training, but also the content of the training. And then secondly, the question of whether continuing education addresses health and safety at all, or if it just generates more students for schools over time. So those things have not been addressed, at least before the committee. And in addition, I have learned for the first time tonight the issue about the whole area of massage or body work that haven't been dealt with here, and that concerns me going forward. So I'm looking for a way for us to allow ourselves some more time to work on this, and it's not clear to me that there's an easy path to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abel.
Maybe we could recall two witnesses that were speaking. Dr. Healy and Jeremy could come down and could talk about, I talked to Representative Bunn on the side there a little bit ago, so why don't we just have you guys come down?
Mr. Miller and Dr. Geely.
Could we answer a question that you had before we leave the table?
I believe this Representative Abel requests the Representative Geely and Mr. Miller to answer this question. And so unless there's a question directed towards...
I've asked a question about the health and safety in general and how one deals with that. And I have a massage therapist up there, so if she would like to address that, that would be fine, too.
Fine.
99% of the professional liability insurance pays for slip and fall. What you'll see in what they've listed here is primarily slip and fall. The cases that were brought before the Department of Health were boundaries, but nothing in the sense of harm to people. Mm-hmm. And so the payout, our insurance is very, very cheap because the payout is very, very low.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the supporting document.
State your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Nancy Hohn. In the supporting document, the list of injuries were done by those who already were members of the professional organizations with high credentials. So
the education didn't prevent those.
It didn't
things.
Prevent it. I know in today's newspaper there was a chiropractor that mm-hmm. was a sex offender, and they're letting him be a chiropractor. Yeah.
Sorry, I had to say
Mr.
that.
Mr. Miller? Mr. Miller and Dr. Healy. To that question.
Thank you, Chair Tao. Representative Bunn, the material that I emailed to you about a week ago, the mm-hmm. packet of evidence for safety, efficacy, and harm for the practice of massage therapy. There is evidence and data to suggest that massage therapy by untrained or incompetent massage therapists does pose a risk. The evidence of that, there's a systematic review in a peer-reviewed medical journal that found that massage therapists, in general, when they're trained, are the practice of massage therapy is generally safe. Massage therapists that are untrained, however, are the practice of that led to cases of what they call adverse events in the medical literature, cerebrovascular accidents or strokes, displacement of a ureteral stent. These are all specific examples of case studies that were in the medical literature. Embolization of the left kidney, hematoma, leg ulcers, nerve damage, posterior interosseous syndrome, pseudoaneurysm, pulmonary embolism, ruptured uterus, strangulation of the neck, various pain syndromes. And the study, in their conclusion, says the majority of adverse events were associated with exotic types of manual massage or massage delivered by laymen, while massage therapists, meaning trained therapists, were rarely implicated. one of the malpractice insurance companies that does offer malpractice insurance for massage therapists gave us a list of specific injuries that were caused by massage therapists that the insurance company made a payment on a claim about massage therapy. And insurance companies, as you well know, don't make payments on claims that don't have merit. Injuries include fractured leg, shoulder injury from chair massage, right clavicle or shoulder right clavicle displacement. I'm trying to think of the layman's term for the clavicle, the collarbone. Right collarbone displacement, dislocated sternum, torn rotator cuff, second degree burns from hot stone massage, rib fracture, herniated disc. These are all claims that were actually paid out by an insurance company, and the causative factor was the massage therapy intervention that was made. The information, as I emailed to you, goes on and on. Am I addressing the question that you're...
Somebody?
Well, your last name, I know the first name, Jeremy. But
Miller.
Miller, thank you. I did scan through the document. I have it right in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could tell me the page of the first one you cited. But what impressed me about what I saw in here is that was that I don't have any sense of numbers whatsoever. And your first point about the things that could go wrong, well, if we're going to allow non-registered massage therapists to still exist in any way they would like, and you've just stated it's the ones that haven't had the training that may be more dangerous, the first argument would be an argument for not allowing anyone to practice without all this training. Okay, so it's an argument for a different kind of bill in some ways. So
we could repeal the CAM law.
Yeah. I didn't.
Just for the record, that's not our intention.
And we didn't get, in terms of these incidences, we have no idea within the hundreds of thousands of massages that go on every year. If you listed the entire list of them, and there's always a trade-off, and so we're going from no regulation at all or under 146 to quite a lot of fees and paperwork for folks in a group of people that do often work part-time, many of whom don't even have health insurance because they're so part-time, to have to take on some extra regulatory burden here. And so to have them do that, we need to have some pretty compelling evidence that there is potential for harm, and moreover that the legislation directly addresses, how this prevents that from occurring on a regular basis. And I've been more, as you know, over the last few weeks, more sympathetic to some of the arguments here. But there's some new things that have been raised tonight that have moved me the other direction again, and particularly the whole body art thing separately, but also the lack of comprehensive case made to us, or even originally any attempt to make it to us, to the whole group, not just to me, about the health and safety argument. So my concern has kind of increased at this point, and I'm concerned about whether we're going to have adequate time to address those things as we go along in this. So I just want to make that comment.
Okay, good. Representative Rude.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. Where is this bill, I guess I can ask Representative Abler, in the Senate?
Representative Abler?
I didn't look. I'm going to phone a friend. Where is it in the...
It's, Mr. Chair, Representative Root, it's been referred to Senator Marty's...
Has it had a hearing, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Root, it has not yet.
Okay. No. And then, Mr. Chair...
Representative Root?
Thank you. Is it the intent of the Chair that we will have a licensing bill that will be... Or will this travel separately onto its next... Stop.
We have tried different approaches over the years, and it looks like the Senate preferred that each bill travel by itself.
Okay, thank you. If I can make a few comments, Mr. Chair, I would echo, I guess, what Representative Bunn was saying. I initially also was, in all the bills that we've kind of reviewed this session, this is one that kind of I think initially made a pretty good case. It's always great to have these hearings because that's what they're for. We learn things. So I also have some reservations. I don't necessarily want to kill the bill, but I would say that it's important that if this bill does go forward, that we have to continue to have those discussions, and I would be happy to be a part of those discussions if it makes it out of committee tonight.
I think you're right. This bill has a long road in front of it. I think it's important to have the discussion and to continue the discussion. I know that the practitioners have been trying to regulate themselves for many, many years. And I believe this is probably the closest they ever gotten to getting something. And I would like to see something happen as well. Representative Abraham.
Well, thank you, and not to belabor anything, I think if anybody knows my particular style, I don't like this kind of bill to become law without it being carefully done. I think given that the Senate, it's good to get the bill moving, and then people come around, and without a hearing, we wouldn't hear it in the Asian body workers, for instance. I don't believe I've met this nice woman before. We're going to chat next week. And so there's ample opportunity to make this bill better, but I think part of this is relief for the massage therapists themselves, but also the safety of the people. But practically, this profession deserves to get out of the quagmire being compared to prostitution. In the testimony of the witnesses for the opposition, I couldn't count how many times they used that word or something like it. This profession is nothing of that kind. And so as this bill works its way through the process, and I hope it can move tonight. And you have my word that I'll work with all of you, and even the opponents. Frankly, that's how I function. Plus, I have time. that would be. I think we can accomplish the good things and keep the bad out. But I won't repeat what I said earlier. So thank you,
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, you know, I appreciate what you're saying. I have, a couple thoughts on that. One, I've not heard until I was here at this body that there was ever a real serious link, at least in my lifetime, between prostitution and massage therapists. They're well-respected in my community, and I've never heard that link. And, of course, I don't live in the Twin Cities big metropolitan area. I live in rural Rochester, so maybe things are different down there. So I don't, you know, I guess I don't feel the need to license something just because of that link. I guess I would prefer that we table this bill this evening, and I would like you to consider that. And I do think there's some continued work that could be done on this. One of my concerns moving forward is when something leaves the licensing committee, it says something to the next committees that we are all supportive of this and that it's ready to go. And I just don't think we're there yet. And I guess I'm leery about giving that thought to the next committee as we move forward until all the issues have been ironed out and you have a majority that really feel comfortable with it. So I guess, Representative Abler, I personally would like to see it tabled and come back later this session if the chair would allow it to come back at another meeting. I think we're having at least one, but perhaps more meetings, Mr. Chair.
The chair intends to vote on all bills present today. Okay. No further discussion. Representative Avery renews his motion that House File 1503, as amended, be referred to Health Human Service Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes carry. Bill is on its way. Okay, we have Representative Murphy, the medical laboratory tech. We will give everybody the same amount, 15 minutes, opponent and proponent, and then we will proceed to move to a vote after the questioning. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 1249 for recommendation and re-referral to Health and Human Services Policy.
That's
this
right.
is the lab tech licensure bill, and I have a crowd here that would like to share their perspective on the work that they've done in this piece of legislation over the last 3 years. So I'd like to turn it over to them.
Okay. State your name for the record, and then you may proceed.
Okay. My name is Kathy Hansen. I'm the former director of the laboratories at University of Minnesota Medical Center, but I'm here in my capacity as co-chair of the Minnesota Laboratory Licensure Coalition. In healthcare today, the focus is on quality and patient safety. In all healthcare professions, the foundation of quality and patient safety relates to the qualifications of the personnel doing the work. In testimony to Congress in 2006, Dr. Dennis O'Leary of the Joint Commission, the organization that accredits hospitals, stated, "The Joint Commission believes that the personnel standards currently required by CLIA are insufficient to adequately protect patients and the public health." CLIA is the federal regulation for laboratories. Over 70% of the objective data used in medical decision making comes from the laboratory, so we are an integral part of diagnosis. The laboratory is not a black box where results happen only because of technology. Recent outbreaks of H1N1 influenza have once again highlighted the importance of timely and accurate lab testing to the health of all Minnesotans. Tests for infectious diseases like H1N1, strep, hepatitis, HIV, and others are just one part of the services that clinical laboratory professionals provide to the public every day. These highly trained professionals also cross-match blood for transfusion in surgery, emergency departments, cancer patients, just to name a few, test for genetic diseases, run diagnostic tests for diabetes, heart disease, and many other conditions. Although some types of testing are automated, more and more types of testing utilize advanced techniques like molecular or DNA-based tests, and incorrect test results may lead to wrong diagnoses, additional expense and suffering, or even death. Just 3 weeks ago, I was asked to consult with a small clinic laboratory that was using untrained testing personnel who actually did meet the CLIA requirements but were not adequately trained or supervised to do what they were doing. For 9 months, blood counts were run without quality control and with failed proficiency testing. The clinic had to try to call back all the patients who had been tested in that time frame for retesting. In some instances, this resulted in delayed treatment. About a third of the patients could not be located to be told of the errors and retested. The laboratory has now been closed. With the safeguards of this bill, this type of situation will not occur. So licensure is what we want to ensure quality and patient safety by ensuring qualifications and competency of laboratory personnel and to gather data on the laboratory workforce for emergency preparedness and workforce planning. Very briefly, the bill sets forth qualifications for each type of lab professional at the associate and baccalaureate degree level. And we know this is somewhat complex, but basically at each type of license, there's a degree required, there's clinical experience, and successful completion of a certification exam. There's one license at the associate degree level, four types at the baccalaureate level, which reflects the complexity of the work that lab professionals do. We've also included a subspecialty license, which does not require a certification exam, for the very specialized work done in some of the laboratories at the Mayo Clinic. And we worked very closely with Mayo on this language. There's a grandfather position granting a license to those who are currently employed in laboratories, even if they don't meet the above qualifications, depending on the type of work they're doing. Renewal of a license, whether it's somebody who meets the qualifications or somebody who's grandfathered in, will require continuing education because this is a continually changing field. And so there will be a level playing field for all types of license holders. We also have included a provision to recognize the need of small labs, which are often rural or in physician offices, which do testing at the point of care. Individuals that hold certification as a medical assistant are exempt from needing a license and may perform testing under the supervision of a medical laboratory scientist licensed under this act. So we believe we've covered the needs of all the types of laboratories in Minnesota.
Before we move forward, Representative Murphy, I forgot. I believe you have the two amendments to put the bill in the shape that the author wants. So why don't you move those?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first is the A-10 amendment, which is a delete everything amendment.
So the A-10-2056.
That's right.
Representative Murphy moves the A-10-2056, delete everything. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Then I believe there's an additional one, too, as well.
There is. Well, there are actually two, Mr. Chair. There was a scribing error in the delete everything amendment, and I'd like to move an oral amendment if I could. There are two errors on page 11. And Ms. Aves helped me find these. She actually did the work and identified them and told me that there were errors, so I should not take any credit.
Oh, it isn't.
At page 11, line 1, the word reviewed should be renewed. And in line 2, delete 148F.10 and insert 148F.11.
Okay, Representative Murphy moves the oral amendments 11.1, delete the word review and put in renewed. And 11.2, delete 148F.10 and insert 148F.11. Okay, all those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay.
And then the A-10-2148, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy moves the A-10-2148. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Now the bill is in the shape that the author wants.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we can proceed with the testimony.
Good evening, everyone. Hi, my name is Deb Rodall, and I am testifying here this evening as a member of the laboratory profession and as a manager with almost 30 years of experience. I am currently employed with the Health East Care System as a laboratory director, but I am not here representing them here tonight. In Minnesota, many laboratories already have hiring practices that comply with the provisions of this bill. However, these practices are voluntary and can be changed at any time. We see evidence of compromised standards in many states due to the financial pressures of hospitals and laboratories, and I've personally been involved with that on some of the national committees that I've represented. Today, laboratory professionals are one of the few healthcare professions not licensed in the state of Minnesota. 12 other states currently license laboratory professionals, 5 states have introduced bills, and about 15 other states are working on bill language. There is growing concern among laboratory professionals regarding the inadequacy of the CLIA personnel standards and the long-term repercussions of quality of laboratory services. By not setting specific requirements or educational standards, the CLIA regulation essentially condones underqualified people to perform the testing. Under the CLIA standards, the majority of testing we do could be done by people with much less education and training than is required in our bill. In many hospitals in the state, often one person is working alone during the night and needs to be fully capable to handle whatever might come their way. They need to have the additional training, experience, and critical thinking skills that their certification helps ensure in order to guarantee quality test results and ability to deal with the unexpected. Despite the advances in medical technology to simplify some laboratory tests and actually make them available for patients to perform themselves, like pregnancy tests, glucose meters, and others, laboratory testing is an exploding field. New, highly complex tests are being introduced every day. Now, highly complex tests, the more complex the patient care treatments, the more complex the laboratory testing becomes. And really, laboratory testing is a vital component of overall patient care. From my standpoint, the people that put the work together to create this bill, they've put a very thorough, thoughtful, and collaborative process.
As a laboratory manager, I appreciate the work that has been done to create a licensure plan that utilizes existing certification processes that will help keep expenses minimal for all involved and keep the processes simplified as well. 10 professional associations, including the Minnesota and the National Pathology Organizations, participated in the development of the bill language. They worked together to do this. They took their time to make it right. The College of American Pathologists and the Minnesota Society for Pathology now support this bill. The Licensure Coalition has tried very hard to involve other stakeholders, such as MHA, MMA, MDH, and the Mayo Clinic and veterans groups, to address the concerns that they have raised. All of these organizations have retracted their opposition and are officially neutral. Concerns have been raised about the supply of qualified individuals. So will, by passing this bill, will we create a shortage of professionals? I think there's good news on that front. There are 9 associate degree programs for medical technology or medical technician generalists at the Minsku two-year colleges, with the Department of Labor recently approving funding for a 10th program at Pine City and 2 other private colleges. These programs can now produce 150 graduates per year and have nearly full enrollments. At present, there are now 5 baccalaureate level programs of medical laboratory science generalists. In Minnesota, the number of programs training 4-year clinical laboratory professionals has increased with the opening of new programs at Fairview, Winona State University, Argosy University, Mayo Clinic, and a forthcoming program from St. Cloud State University in the fall of 2010. In addition, the University of Minnesota laboratory program is being expanded in Rochester and Winona. Current statewide capacity for educating these professionals will increase from 46 5 years ago to approximately 150 over the course of the next few years. In addition, there are multiple online programs available to complete this education and to be eligible for certification. Minnesota is really fortunate to be in this position, and I will say it's been through the hard efforts of laboratory people from across the state and educators from across the state. We've worked hard to put ourselves in this position. I think in closing, I would like to see this bill pass so that when I am no longer the one hiring, I have the assurance and confidence that the person doing lab work on my family and friends is licensed to do so. Why would we not want to assure minimum education and certification standards for the professionals performing your laboratory tests? Why should this not be as important as the standards for competency that you expect from physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and other professionals? Supporting this bill, I believe, is the right thing to do.
State your name for the record, and you may proceed.
My name is John McClure, and I am a pathologist at Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park. I'm here tonight to convey to you my concern that a crisis is looming in medical laboratory testing. Personnel shortages and medical economics make it more challenging than ever to provide quality medical laboratory testing. I am and have been a medical director in many laboratories. Unequivocally, the most important element of quality laboratory testing is the laboratory staff. I am a physician medical director, but I do not perform any testing in the laboratory. Physicians, by and large, have a very limited understanding of the performance of the laboratory tests that drive the bulk of medical diagnosis. These tests are performed by clinical laboratory scientists and technicians. They are the ones who determine if instruments are functioning properly. They are the ones who identify results which are suspect and need further investigation. This is a weighty responsibility which is invisible to most physicians, nurses, and patients. I'm fortunate to work in an organization which requires all of our testing personnel to be certified. They must graduate from an accredited program and pass a national certifying exam. This requirement is voluntary. Not every laboratory in the state of Minnesota imposes such a requirement. The CLIA regulations do not require any sort of certification. Most laboratory testing can be performed legally with a high school diploma or equivalent and appropriate training slash experience. The requirement for training beyond a high school diploma does not stipulate a setting or duration of training and requires no satisfactory test performance. Participation in an accredited training program and a minimum performance on an exam do not guarantee a competent laboratorian, but to require less is irresponsible.
You have 3 minutes.
My fear is for the future. I'm charged with the ethical and legal responsibility to assure that testing in my laboratories is of the highest quality. The quality of the staff is the most important element in this process, but I neither employ nor control the staff. The national shortage of competent staff and the economic pressures facing healthcare systems are creating a perfect storm, driving the use of individuals with inadequate training to perform laboratory testing. The pressure to take this easy way out will increase. No one will be immune from these pressures. Staff cutbacks and pressure to use less well-trained, less expensive staff are a daily fact of life in Minnesota hospitals. I do not want to be confronted with a choice between leaving my practice and compromising my standards of quality testing. Licensure is the first minimum step to provide a base level of qualification standards to make sure that the most important element of quality medical testing isn't compromised for the citizens of Minnesota. Thank you.
And I believe Mr. Penny.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rick Panning. I am testifying today as the co-chair of the Minnesota Medical Laboratory Licensure Coalition, representing 10 laboratory professional organizations in the state. I'm currently the vice president of lab services at Allina Hospitals and Clinics. Allina has not taken a position on this bill for or against, consistent with their policy on all healthcare licensure initiatives. I would like to start by asking the question, why is it that so many oppose licensure of laboratory professionals? First and foremost, I believe that there is a general lack of knowledge of what it is that we do and the education that it requires. We are usually in the background and often in the basement. However, the work performed is essential to high-quality healthcare and patient safety. Just today, I was interviewed by a career publication about the lab profession and current issues that we are dealing with. The last question that they asked me was, what is the biggest misconception about your profession? My answer was that beside the fact that everyone thinks we are nurses, is the fact that everyone thinks anyone can do this work, and that the technology is what really does the work. This is blatantly incorrect. We have a defined body of knowledge and a scope of practice, just as physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and others do. We would not expect to perform their duties and should not expect that they can perform ours. The other people tonight have talked about the CLIA regulations. We have federal regulations, and shouldn't that be enough for us to operate under?
Mr. Penny, I'm going to let you wrap it up. I'm sorry,
Okay. Opposition that you're going to hear about shortly is comes from primarily from the Association, American Association of Bioanalysts, AAB. Their opposition to the bill is based on the fact that they do not believe there is a need for a bachelor's level of practice in this profession and that we only need the associate degree. We need both. The associate degree people are trained very broadly and very well technically, but in addition, the bachelor's degree people have that critical thinking and judgment and background to make clinical decisions that is needed. They've also opposed us based on the fact that there's a fear that people will lose their jobs if this bill is passed. The reality is that that will not happen. Grandfathering will protect that. There's also a fear that people will leave the state to find jobs elsewhere. We have not seen that happen in other states, and it has not happened in North Dakota, who's had licensure since 1992. And finally, there's an opposition based on the fact that military-trained personnel will not be able to get a license under our bill. We have worked hard on that. We've worked with all of the veterans groups in the state of Minnesota. They currently support our bill and have consulted with us on numerous times. I'd like to close by just reaffirming what has already been said. The laboratory profession relies heavily on the people that do the work. It is not a black box. Like nursing, pharmacy, and other areas of healthcare, the work performed by our professionals does require education, training, certification, and ongoing competency assessment. Not just anyone can perform the work. There is no magic black box. I ask you finally, why are elevated personnel standards not necessary for this profession, which supports so much of the diagnosis that happens, when they are felt to be so important for other healthcare professions? I urge you to support passage of House File 1249, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Ms. Ashley Wong, and then after the opponents will take questioning.
Good Thanks. It's been a really long night, so I'm going to keep this brief. I've been up since 5 a.m. working in the lab, and I have to get up at 5 again tomorrow. So I just wanted to go to first introduce myself. My name is Ashley Wong. I'm a lab supervisor and a technical supervisor in a small clinical lab in Woodbury. I'm here to provide comments on the bill on behalf of the American Association of Bioanalysts. They represent lab managers, lab employees in Minnesota, and it's a nationally recognized leader in lab safety and quality issues. Its Minnesota members include clinical lab directors, owners, managers, supervisors, technologists, technicians, and phlebotomists. HF 1249 requires a bachelor's degree, no exceptions, for individuals who perform high-complexity lab testing. We're not opposing licensure. We tried to add language to the bill to allow individuals with associate's or AA degrees who are authorized under CLIA to already perform these high-level testing to continue to do these tests. For example, deleted lines 11.3 and 4 and replaced them with possess the minimum degree required by CLIA or the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act. And unfortunately, this suggestion was not accepted. Fairview and Health East oppose this bill, and none of the people that presented this evening are representing hospitals that support this bill. In fact, CAP actually does not support this bill. They just don't oppose it. And those are
who's CAP?
College of American Pathologists. Currently, CLIA allows people with either an AA or a Bachelor's of Art degree to perform high-complexity lab tests. And many high-complexity tests in rural hospitals are performed with individuals without bachelor's degrees. Restricting who can perform these high-complexity tests in rural hospitals will delay diagnosis and treatment for patients in crisis, for example, salmonella testing. That test can only be detected with a high-complexity lab test. AAB suggested adding language to the bill, like I talked about, and that was not accepted. But that means that Minnesota lab directors that are in compliance with CLIA right now, by allowing techs with 2 years degrees to perform the high-complexity lab testing, will be breaking Minnesota law, which restricts who is allowed to perform these tests. And under the bill, these bachelor degrees can be in any field, English, art history, urban studies, or voice. And this means a person who's majoring in dance but minors in chemistry could be licensed to perform a high-complexity lab test, while a person with an associate's degree, an associate's lab tech degree, can't. So federal regulations implementing CLIA explicitly and exclusively vest the lab director, which were some of the people who are testifying, with the sole responsibility for directing the quality control programs in the clinical laboratory under Code of Federal Regulation 493.1407. These federal regulations are strictly enforced. And in my field, we have on-site inspections by CAP and other organizations like the state of Minnesota and the FDA. And we have to have those every 2 years. And those involve quality, point-of-care testing, and personnel competency reviews, which the lab director is accountable for. So HF 1249 prohibits military-trained techs as well from performing high-complexity lab testing because they lack a Bachelor's of Arts degree, and that suggests that an active-duty soldier in Afghanistan or Iraq can conduct a high-complexity lab test on an injured soldier, but that same person should be prohibited from conducting that same test while working in a Minnesota hospital or clinic upon discharge is inappropriate. The AAB proposed amending the bill to allow these individuals trained by the Department of Defense to allow them to serve as MLTs and med techs, and we hope the proponents will accept that change to assure veterans who risk their lives in war may contribute to our society when they return home. And you may have heard privately from hospitals that the Bachelor's of Arts requirement will increase their labor costs. I'm sure you've all have talked to them at the time when they're facing millions of dollars in revenue cuts should the GAMC program go away. In the past year, Minnesota's hospitals have laid off thousands of employees, driving up hospital labor costs by forcing them to hire more techs with Bachelor's of Arts degrees. May make four-year techs happy, but will do nothing to control healthcare costs or enhance quality. burdening rural labs and small clinics like mine, hospital labs with enhanced pay, but have no impact on the accuracy of tests conducted is just, I don't think, the right decision. That's why I'm here tonight. And preventing associates of or AA degree techs from performing high complexity tests will create more works for techs with bachelor's of arts degrees and increase lab and healthcare costs, but make no difference really in the safety of our patients. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Are there anyone else from the audience who are in opposition? Ms. Wong, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Or even for the proponents. How many people are in with an AA are currently in the profession?
I would have to defer.
Is it the majority or small percentage?
Well, I can hold up a sheet of my, and I have one for each member, but this is a listing of every employee in my laboratory, and we have 30 employees in my entire clinic. The highlighted portions would all be people not able to be licensed under this bill. So we have quite a few of MLTs working in our lab side by side by some med techs who perform independent weekend work, who perform testing on a daily basis quite well for my lab director.
How many is that in your lab? Is it the majority or?
I would say it's even, okay. Evenly spaced.
And I have an additional question, both for the opponent and proponent. Has anyone, under the current system, has a lab tech been disciplined for a lack of skills or knowledge, or has it been, danger to the clients?
I guess I have no, but I do have technicians that my lab director deems from hire based on his or her performance that she doesn't do some duties in our lab, not because of any disciplinary action, but he deemed that person's aptitude or qualifications were not appropriate for that level of testing. And that's really what CLIA is giving the lab director right now control to do. So even if you have a bachelor's degree but are inappropriate based on some other personal or technical incompetencies or inabilities, he deems what based on some other personal or technical incompetencies or inabilities, he deems what you can and cannot do.
Okay. Same question for either Mr. Penning and Ms. Hansen. Same two questions, if you care.
I think the proportion of associate versus baccalaureate degree people, that was your first question, I believe, varies considerably according to setting. Most hospitals have a preponderance of baccalaureate degree people, except in the rural areas, the critical access hospitals tend to employ more associate degree people. And then when you get to the clinic level, it's associate degrees and some certified medical assistants. In terms of discipline, since there is no license, there's not really a way of disciplining people by taking away a license. And I personally have had the experience of doing corrective action and discipline internally within our laboratory, and eventually letting somebody go who was not a competent practitioner, only to find out weeks later that they're working across town at another hospital, because there is no way of communicating that information about incompetent practitioners in the absence of a license.
Chairman Tal, first of all, on the percentages, I work for a large organization, and our large metro hospitals, our mix is 70% bachelor's, 30% associate. In our outstate regional hospitals, it's more like 50-50. And in the clinic part of our organization, it's probably 95% technician. In terms of the discipline, I'd have to answer similar to Kathy Hansen in that we handle those cases on a case-by-case basis. it is dealt with as an organization, but when, once it leaves the organization, we don't have much control. I'd also like to say that I think it's incorrect to say that the bill does not allow technician-level, associate-level people to do high-complexity testing. That's absolutely false, because it does not change what they can perform in terms of their current scope of practice. That does not change in this bill.
But they would need a BA. No.
They will not.
Okay. I see Mr. Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, members, Tom Lehman representing the American Association of Bioanalysts. In response to your question, Mr. Chairman, about what percentage of things do, if members would turn to page 5 of the, I guess it's the bill, continuing on to page 6, it lists a number of exceptions of folks that will not be licensed under this bill, as I understand it. And if you go on to page 6, it lists down at 618, cytotechnologists, hictotechnicians, histotechnologists, continuing on to 628, individuals who only perform wave tests or moderately complex point-of-care tests. So there's a whole category of folks that work in labs that are not covered by that. In terms of what percentage that population includes, the national data is cytology and and this may be different for Minnesota, but this is national data. Cytology and histology account for about 40% of lab revenues and procedures. Wave tests are about 7%. Point-of-care, probably a couple of percent. So the folks that are exempted that work in the lab are at least about half of all the activities in the lab. So, again, our perspective is if this licensure is good, why would you, at the very, you know, page 5 and 6, say for a whole multiple categories of professionals, this doesn't apply to you? Thank you.
Any additional questions from members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for any of the testifiers, I just had two quick questions, just kind of nationally how we fit in. You referenced North Dakota, I believe one of the testifiers did, as being a state that has licensure. Can you tell me how many other states have licensure?
There are currently, Representative Dean, there are currently only 12 states that have licensure in place. There are currently 5 other states that are doing a similar thing and have introduced bills in their legislature, and 15 states preparing for that step.
Mr. Chair, how does that, is there any federal laws that this will have to fit into other than the Department of Human Services? Is there anything federally that you have to lock into with this particular piece of legislation?
Mr. Penny?
Representative Dean, I mean, other than CLIA, which is a very different set of regulations that we're trying to build upon and raise higher, there are no other federal regulations. We each, as our opposition has stated tonight, we choose under CLIA to be accredited by different organizations. Many of us choose the College of American Pathologists, which do try to help raise those levels, but we're building on CLIA. There are no other federal requirements.
And I would like to add something, please. Of the 12 states where lab licensure, with lab personnel licensure, only one state, which is New York, has enacted a lab licensure law since CLIA was enacted. Mm-hmm. And the other states have not enacted licensure because there's already a national standard now. And frankly, New York has admitted that licensure law has harmed quality.
Mr. Chair, final question. Could you tell me about, I'm just kind of concerned that people might be moving from or to states with other licensure. Can you just talk about reciprocity, if there's anything set up with that, and then also about the impact on existing hospitals? I know we're really getting hit hard every day with the struggles that our hospitals are under and just trying to keep the doors open now. The impact I'm concerned about, particularly with rural hospitals, if it is indeed the fact that indeed half of the folks there would be considered, they would be grandfathered in, but currently considered not eligible for this technical licensure. I'm somewhat concerned about that.
Ms. Henson?
With regard to your first question about reciprocity, there is reciprocity between all the states that currently have licensure. They all recognize the same national certification exams, with the current exception of California, which administers its own exam. California was the first state with licensure back in 1937. Within the next couple of years, they expect to move to the same model as the other states, though, and discontinue administration of their own exam and start using the same ones that everyone else uses. So we don't feel that that's an issue. With regard to the cost, there are published studies that show that salaries are not different in licensed states than in unlicensed states, and that there is no measurable impact on the cost of care. I know we said that many of the rural hospitals employ the two-year people. They can still do that. This bill does not change the scope of practice of the two-year people, and we really don't anticipate any major change for them.
And I guess, Representative Dean, I would add one other thing to that. When it was talked about by Mr. Lehman a few minutes ago, that such a high percentage are exempt from the bill, although cytology and histology might account for 40% of the revenue, I blame that on the pathologist, the amount of people in those, I know that in my organization, less than 10% are cytotechs and histotechs. And as we stated, cytology was exempted because CLIA is very strong in cytology. They don't need more regulation. CLIA requires them to be certified, have annual personal proficiency testing, and workload restrictions. And histology is a different part of the lab. They don't necessarily perform and report results. They're performing a very important function of preparing specimens for the pathologist to evaluate. And the waived exemption, in my organization, that doesn't apply to anybody in our organization because we don't have personnel in any of our laboratories who only perform waived testing. Waived is part of what they do, but they also do moderately testing. There are waived-only labs, but they're relatively small in number in Minnesota.
Mr. Penning, is currently your laboratory techs are under CLIA or operate under CLIA's rules, or?
Chairman Tao, CLIA provides a basic minimal set of standards, and about 75% of what we do could be done by people with a high school degree with documented training on the job. We perform at a higher level so that our MLTs, two-year associate degree and four-year people, are doing that moderate complex and highly complex. CLIA provides a more minimal set of standards. We're building on top of that.
Wouldn't it make sense to, if you want to increase the quality, try to maybe up the level for CLIA?
CLIA was passed in 1988. Has been talked about it being amended numerous times, and as I mentioned in my testimony, or maybe I didn't because I got shortened, the current commissioner of CLIA that is under the CMS department of the federal government is proposing, and for our profession actually to take forward on their legislative day in Washington in March, to have amendments to CLIA because of the documented problems with CLIA currently. But no active, successful measure to amend CLIA has been able to occur since 1988.
Ms. Wong?
I just wanted to speak to the fact that 10 out of the 11 states with lab tech licensure laws have had a higher percentage of labs with reported conditional level deficiencies in 2004, according to CMS data. So the percentage of labs with reported condition level deficiencies in Minnesota was reported to be 3.2%. And the 10 states were California, 3.9%, Florida, 4.1%, Georgia, 4.3%, Hawaii, 5.3%, Louisiana, 12.1%, Montana, 7.3%, North Dakota, 10.1%, Nevada, 4.1%, Rhode Island, 0%, Tennessee, 10.7%, and West Virginia, 7.1%. We are doing a good job.
Okay. Yeah. Any questions? Okay, Representative Murphy? Oh, comments? Representative Bunn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you to all the presenters. Some good information tonight. Just want to add one final comment is when this was being initially discussed last year, a lot of additional information than what was heard tonight was presented in the way of studies on both sides of the issue were presented to address the issue of whether there was a safety or quality problem that needed addressed. There was various kinds of research studies on both sides of that issue. I did spend almost an entire Sunday afternoon one time reading all of it and concluded that there wasn't compelling, statistically significant evidence to support the view that this was a problem that would be fixed by this legislation. So not that there wasn't some evidence, but there wasn't the weight of evidence did not support that at that time. So, I'm glad we've had the discussion both last year and this, but, you know, it remains to be seen whether we have a problem that this actually fixes in my mind.
Representative Murphy, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Park Nicollet's leadership has reviewed this bill and they're comfortable with the language. I think that was a misstatement by Ms. Wong. And with that, I'd like to lay House File 1249 on the table.
Okay. Bill's been laid on the table. Meeting adjourned.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
You adjourned awfully quickly, and I would like to say, if I'd had a chance to talk to Representative Murphy, I was going to reconsider, and I want to just say to you that I would appreciate, I did have the authority to reconsider. I believe I was a little bit preempted by your comment that said we were going to vote on the bill earlier. So not this bill, the bill prior to this. I kind of feel, Mr. Chair, that had I been able to make my request to lay the bill on the table, that perhaps we would have been able to do so. I think it would be difficult at this time to reconsider it. So not having had the opportunity to talk to some of my colleagues, I'm going to not make that make that motion. But as Chair, I look to you for assistance, and I didn't get it this time. So hopefully next time, if you see me struggling with something like that, that you would offer me the opportunity that if I wanted to lay it on the table that I needed to make that motion, and I would have appreciated that. I've been here 4 years, but not quite long enough to know all the rules yet. Thank you.
It's time to learn. Thank you.